Let me start by telling you a bit about myself. So I'm a professor of physics at the University of Sydney in Australia, and within something called the Centre for Engineered Quantum Systems. I'm a quantum physicist. I'm a theoretical quantum physicist looking at questions in quantum information and quantum computation, and a bit of the foundations of quantum mechanics. I'd be very happy to talk with any of you about any of those subjects during the next couple weeks. And I'm very happy to be giving some lectures, basically at the start of a graduate level course in quantum mechanics. So it's my favorite subject. I'm originally from this part of the world. I grew up very near here, and I went to the University of Waterloo for my undergraduate degree. I then went to Toronto for my PhD and then moved to Australia shortly after that, quite a long time ago. I've been down there ever since. There's quite a big community in Australia, just like in Canada, for doing fundamental research into the ideas of building a quantum computer. As for this course, it's a bit of a challenge for me. So first of all, this is the first time I've given this course and the first time I've really had anything to do with the SCI program, even though I've visited Perimeter many times over the past few years as a researcher and interacted with some of the SCI students and been very impressed by everyone. I really like this program. This is the first time I've lectured into it and the first time I've lectured this course. And it's a bit of a challenge because all of you have done some amount of quantum mechanics before. Am I right? Probably some of you have done quite a bit of quantum mechanics before in your undergraduate. But what you've done has probably is probably very varied between one student and the other. So some of you will have done some things that I'm intending to cover in this course. Some of you might not really have gone into a lot of depth into some of the things I'm going to take as assumed knowledge for this course. So it's a bit of a challenge to try to pitch it at the right level for such an audience with a varied background. I'm going to rely on you guys to let me know if I'm going too slow through something, if something's obvious. Nobody ever tells me something's obvious, but please feel free to say, especially if you want to talk to me after the lecture, yeah, I think most of us have done this before and we'd like to hear some more in-depth detail into that. Maybe we can go a bit faster. What's maybe more likely is that some of you will say, you know, I've been talking to the other students and nobody seems to quite know what you're going on about in that area. Can we slow down a bit and look at that in some more detail? So I'm very happy to adjust these lectures as we go along. If you tell me that you want to go more in depth into something, if you want to refresh some of the background on some of the material, we can adapt things as we go along. Aggie's the side tutor for this course. She's put up the draft schedule on the wiki, which I have not yet been exposed to, but I'll figure that out as well now that I'm here. And if you look at the lecture schedule on there, it's still a bit of a draft. This week where we do two rather intense mornings, and then next week it's probably pretty solid, but that third week, there's a bunch of special topics. Those are still very much up in the air. We can decide to go in more depth into one of them. We can decide to skip one of them. If there's something you really want to hear about, we can even talk about adding something to it. So have a look at that draft schedule. Think a bit about what that means with respect to your own background in quantum physics. Hopefully it sounds right, and by all means, come and talk to me at lunch or something if you have any questions about that. Any questions right now? It all sounds good? Let's get started. I thought I'd begin actually with a couple slides from my undergrad lectures that I give to our second year students at Sydney. who are really doing quantum mechanics for the first time. They do some modern physics in first year, but in second year is maybe the same with you, really where we get exposed to the machinery of quantum mechanics. I put up a couple slides as a bit of a motivation for why we're doing this. Because if you're like me, maybe quantum mechanics is actually what got you interested in doing physics in the first place, especially theoretical physics. I think it's by far the most fascinating aspect of modern theoretical physics. In fact, almost all of modern theoretical physics is based on quantum theory in one form or another. And there's still, it's a bottomless pit of puzzles and conceptual things that you have to struggle with and so on. I don't know how this was all introduced to you in your undergrad, but it's quite traditional to introduce a whole lot of ideas in quantum mechanics that are weird in some way, and to emphasize the weirdness and the non-classicalness of some of those aspects of quantum mechanics. So you can write a long list, and it's not meant to be a complete list, but this is the type of thing you probably saw, well, you probably read about even in high school when you're reading some popular things about quantum mechanics, but certainly you would get exposed to these type of ideas in your undergraduate physics. Things that look quite weird, and people talk about the weirdness of it. You can't talk about the position and momentum of a particle at the same time. You can't even talk about them at all. To sort of say that a particle has a position is somehow verboten in quantum mechanics. We can only talk about the outcome of measurements. That's very abhorrent to someone who went into physics to try to explain what's going on out there in the world. This weird idea of complementarity, that waves can behave like particles, particles behave like waves. What does that exactly mean? Looking at particles affects its motion. You have Schrödinger's cat, which is a cat. It's both alive and dead at the same time in a box. What does that mean? It sounds weird. Quantum tunneling, where you have a classically forbidden region keeping a particle in a box, and yet somehow it can pop outside of the box. And then there's even weirder stuff like quantum entanglement, that's where we can have correlations between particles, which in some way we're not able to align or make sense with the classical worldview of correlated particles that have observable properties. So a lot of this stuff would have been introduced to you as weird, but you're supposed to accept it. And if you follow the rules of quantum mechanics, which is actually a very nice closed theory that's not even that challenging to frame in its simplest form, a nice closed theory where you can calculate things like probabilities of measurement outcomes and so on. If you do that, it all works. So there's an element of sort of, trust me, we've done a whole bunch of experiments. This is the way the world is. It's weird, and accepting that weirdness is taking you to a new level of enlightenment in our understanding of the universe. I don't like that approach. Because it, in a sense, it buries some of the questions of why. Why are things like that? Why is stuff weird? Why am I not allowed to do some of these things? So we have quantum mechanics as like our most accurate scientific theory. It's actually a framework for a whole bunch of theories, but the fundamental theories we make out of it, like quantum field theory, the standard model, these are the most accurate scientific predictions that we have. And if you follow along and just shut up and calculate, you get the right answer. But we got into physics because we wanted to understand things and know why things occur. So that's a bit unsatisfying. But that's not the only unsatisfying thing. You might just say, well, that's aesthetics, right? There's more unsatisfying things when we try to apply quantum mechanics in some extreme regimes, such as where we expect gravity to also dominate. So the quantum mechanics that goes on in the very early universe or at the surface of a black hole, where we look for having some theory of quantum gravity and we find that that has a lot of problems to it. And people really believe, and you're at the center of this belief here in the Perimeter Institute, people really believe that quantum gravity is going to serve as a tool, a way forward for us to figure out both a lot of the problems in quantum mechanics and a lot of the problems in gravity. So we can't make those two theories fit together at the moment, but somehow asking the fundamental questions, well, why is quantum mechanics not working right when we try to apply it to gravity, that's going to give us enlightening answers, not just for quantum gravity, but for quantum mechanics in general. There's this strange thing which doesn't get emphasized a lot when you study what you'd call broad theoretical physics in terms of quantum field theory and its applications to space-time and gravity and string theory and so on. The idea of quantum measurement as really a different set of rules than the Schrödinger equation. Quantum mechanics says quite starkly that there are two rules that govern how things happen. When you're not measuring things, things behave one way. And when you measure something, things behave in a very different way that relies on the existence of an observer and so on, something that's outside of the theory. And why are those measurements different than everything else? We'll see in this course some relationships between evolution under measurement and evolution under the Schrödinger equation. But still, there's a fundamental problem in there about what is measurement in quantum mechanics and why is it different than everything else? And one of my favorite things is really to ask, what was Einstein going on about? He's quite rightly recognized as the greatest scientific thinker of the 20th century, perhaps one of the greatest thinkers in all of time. He was responsible for getting quantum mechanics in its current form and going, as well as his contributions to relativity and thermodynamics. And he had some profound objections to the way that we understand quantum mechanics. And I think we have to take those seriously. There's an unfortunate fashion at the moment, I think, to say Einstein was wrong. Einstein didn't get it. He was missing something. If only he understood entanglement. People like to do this to say, well, I get it. Einstein didn't understand it, but I get it in some way. I don't think we get it. Einstein, his genius was he saw the problem. There is a problem with our understanding of quantum mechanics. He was able to see the problem, if not the solution. Okay. So these are all some things that will make us want to push a bit beyond quantum mechanics is weird, look at all these weird things, and try to get a bit of a deeper understanding. From my own personal view, working in the field of quantum information, trying to do things like build quantum computers, we ask questions like, when can a quantum computer be better than any conventional computer? What types of problems can it solve faster? What types of things can it do better? I don't think we're going to be able to definitively answer those questions unless we resolve some of these questions, because what a quantum computer can do fundamentally is really at the heart of what is quantum mechanics and what are the answers to some of these fundamental questions. So there's a real imperative now, much more so than 100 years ago when these questions were first asked, to figure out some answers as to the why. Any questions on that? Are you motivated? Okay, so having given my sort of sermon on the subject, let's back off a bit from the grandiose, and let's step back and try to formulate what is quantum theory a bit axiomatically with some of the postulates. In a way that is going to let us at least work through some of the machinery, build up some of the more sophisticated sort of graduate level machinery in quantum mechanics, and then we can start returning to some of these more fundamental questions. We'll already get a bit of that tomorrow when I think we'll start to look at entanglement and correlation and Bell inequalities and things like that. But for the moment, let's just step back and see if we can formulate quantum mechanics. Now, here's where, in a sense, the lecture is the most difficult to give, because for some of you, this will really seem a bit old hat. Maybe you've seen a lot of this before. I'm going to talk about what are Hilbert spaces and things like that. I'm going to try to embellish it a bit. I'm going to add some things that are really sort of more of a graduate level description. But I apologize for some of you. This may seem quite familiar. For others, maybe the specific notation I'm using is new. So let's get on the same page with the notation, at least. For maybe some of you, there'll be aspects of this which are quite new. And I'm going to go through it quickly. The key thing is, I guess I'm going to try to refer you to some standard textbooks where you can sort of, if you have time over the weekend, fill in some of those gaps in your background if you have any. Okay. I'd be very happy if people start interrupting with questions, saying, you know, okay, you went over that very quickly, didn't quite get that. Can you elaborate on that? Can you explain some of those technical details? Now is a good time for you guys to interrupt me, and we can try to go through this together. Okay? I'm going to follow. It's pretty standard stuff, so there's many textbooks you can use. I personally love this textbook on quantum information and quantum computation by Mike Nielsen and Ike Schwong, of which there are hundreds, if not thousands, of copies floating around this building in the library and people's offices. Get your hands on that if you want to have a text reference to what I'm looking at today. I'm not going to follow what they've done exactly, but it's a good source for the stuff I'm covering today and tomorrow. Okay. So, let's get started. I'm not going to flash up. Yep, question already.
Are the slides going to be available on the wiki?
Sure, that's easy, right? So let me tell you what I'm going to do. Aside from those first couple of introductory slides, now I have a pen. Now I have blank slides that will sometimes have some figures and so on. But largely, it's going to be much more like a blackboard chalk and talk, okay, normal lecture. If you guys, by the way, you know, object to, I'm trying this out with my iPad and pen. I've been trying it out for the last month or two. It seems to work well. But if you guys say, you know what, I'd really prefer if you just use the blackboard, I'm happy to switch to that as well. Okay, so let me know what you think of it after today, this morning's lectures. And if you want future lectures on the blackboard, we can do that. As it is, I can write on this, and then I can convert it all to a PDF file and put that up on the wiki, so you'll have all of those lecture notes. Okay? Okay, I put up operational quantum mechanics. What does that mean? It is a perspective on dealing with quantum mechanics where we back off from all of those fundamental questions about what is the quantum wave function and its meaning, and what does it say about reality, and what's really occurring in a measurement, and is trying to put a bare bones, minimal interpretation on the theory in order to just start to formulate a framework for predicting the outcomes of experiments. So operational quantum mechanics is a way of using the machinery of quantum mechanics to say there's an experiment happening in a lab, or a thought experiment, a Gedanken experiment, and I just want to describe it. Okay, so what would an experiment look like? Well, okay, you're going to laugh because I'm going to draw a very theorist view of what an experiment looks like. I start off with some sort of box that spits out something, out this port. Mm-hmm. And this box might have some knobs on it and some buttons. These are all sort of settings. I'll make it explicit that they're classical. I can fiddle with these things in a lab and press a button, and out pops something that I feel I need to describe using quantum mechanics. Okay, so we call this operation a preparation. So what we might imagine here in, say, a Stern-Gerlach experiment is, you know, like I have an oven that's heating up atoms of silver and accelerating them through some voltage, you know, out of a port. It's preparing my atoms and sending them out. Maybe it has to go through the first analyzer in order to polarize some of them. I don't know. There's a description of what I'm doing in the lab. I set it all up, and that's making my systems that I'm calling quantum states. So I describe preparations within operational quantum mechanics with quantum states. Now, then I want to do something with that system, so I have another piece of equipment, or several, or maybe it's just some magnetic fields or something like that, which is going to transform the state. Quantum system goes into this box, which is going to do something to it, and comes out the other side. Again, maybe there's some knobs on this thing that I can adjust, strength of the field or something like that. This is a transformation. This is describing the evolution of my quantum system, maybe under some Hamiltonian that is characterized by some classical parameters that I'm setting, the electric fields, magnetic fields, and so on. This could be one of my magnetic field gradients in a Stern-Gerlach analyzer. So how do I describe these transformations in quantum mechanics? Well, we say you solve the Schrödinger equation, you get some resulting unitary transformation. Which will act on my preparation, which is a quantum state, and change it in some way. And then the experiment has to end with me measuring something. So let me put a final special box that takes in this quantum system. And it might also have some settings or buttons. But most importantly, it's got a meter or something on it that I can read off a value. I'm going to call the value m for a measurement outcome. It could be a quantized value. It can only take certain values. It could be continuous. I might just be measuring a current or something like that. Here we have a measurement. And how did we describe these? We have either that we can use projections in a basis, or we can use some sort of observable. So what comes out of this thing is a result, but no more quantum system anymore. So the nice thing about this operational framework is you don't have to talk even about, you know, the existence of electrons or whether they have, you know, a position or anything like that. You just have a bunch of things with a completely classical description. Okay, I set some parameters on this thing, which I'm calling the preparation. You know, I can imagine maybe something's coming out of there, electrons with some spin, but that's not part of my picture. I can imagine that if I want, but I don't need to. I've just set up something, then they've set the parameters on my transformation, my field, and at the end I get some clicks or some current on my measurement device. And what I want to do as a physicist is to say, oh, is there a relationship between the settings that I do over here and in the middle and the outcomes that I get at the end? And I should be able to use machinery of quantum mechanics to predict the probabilities of getting various outcomes depending on what settings I made earlier. I don't have to talk about particles at all. It's very unsatisfying in that sense. We're like, well, you know, okay, what's going on in there? I don't know. But operational quantum mechanics doesn't demand yet that I ask that question. I'm free to think whatever I want. I can put whatever interpretation I want on a theory. But I don't need to within this framework. Is that clear what I mean by that? Yeah? Do people like that framework? You shouldn't, because it's not very satisfying. It doesn't say anything about what's going on. You don't even have to talk about particles and spins and so on. But it's very utilitarian. Yep?
How can we know that being a gun from the preparation step is a quantum nature? Without measuring it, without knowing anything, just putting some button, how can we be sure that whatever comes out of that has this quantum?
Yeah, that's a very good question and a tricky one. I guess the first thing you might do is, so say you didn't know how to even describe this. You're like, what space do my quantum states live in? What are those unitary transformations in that projectors? Sort of goes back to that first question, what space do they live in? That ends up sort of setting what could be those unitaries. They have to act on that Hilbert space. What are those measurements? They have to be projectors on that Hilbert space. So figuring out what that Hilbert space is the first step in answering your question. Do I need a quantum system? Is anything quantum going on at all? Well, good question. In fact, people might take a set of experiments, and the first thing they might look for is can I find a classical description of what's going on in here? Can I have an operational classical mechanics that says, oh, well, you've set these preparations, transformations, measurements, you have a whole bunch of statistics, and look, I can explain everything that you've observed with a classical theory. If you can do that, yeah, you don't have a quantum system at all. So that's actually quite a common practice and argument when people, you know, submit some experimental paper on quantum mechanics to a journal, and the referees will go, well, have you really shown that you've got a quantum experiment here? I have its following classical explanation for what you've done. The challenge on the experimenter is to show that I can create enough range of phenomena within this set of preparations, transformations, measurements that I'm going to be able to show that there is no such classical description. And part of that comes down to in the set of quantum states to be able to show that I can do more than just prepare states in some basis. I have to be able to create superpositions. So we'll get into some of those details. But yeah, it's a very good question to ask. Now, okay, so these things should be familiar to you. You've all seen the idea of quantum states before. Unitary transformations and observables. Maybe you haven't heard the expression projections in a basis, but we'll cover that briefly. All of these things, we're going to spend this morning generalizing, well, I should say this morning and tomorrow, because we can extend this theory of operational quantum mechanics a bit beyond this simple description. You can start to ask, well, what's the full range of things which might cover all possibilities of how I can, you know, do preparations, transformations, and measurements? We'll see that it is more, it is enlightening to extend the idea of quantum states to density operators, to extend the range of possibilities of transformation from unitaries to a set of more general quantum operations. Which have a mathematical description as completely positive trace preserving maps. That's a sort of a technical definition for what is the mathematical space of general quantum operations. There's more general types of measurements that we can do, which we'll definitely cover today. They go under the name of positive operator valued measures. We're going to define what all of these things are, but they're a way of saying, well, there's experiments where it doesn't quite fit into this description because I don't really have a unitary transformation. There's a bit of noise on my system. It's coupling a bit to its environment and losing some of my coherence. How do I describe that? My measurements are not these idealizations. They're a bit noisy, but also I can do more types of measurements than the simple ones that we've introduced in quantum mechanics. There's a whole range of phenomena I can capture with a more general notion of what measurements are. And the idea that I can have some uncertainty, or I can classical uncertainty, or that I can imagine quantum systems that are only a component of a larger quantum system, that leads me to start thinking about a density operator description. So we'll see how, in understanding sort of the complete generality of describing these three steps, we're led to a more general type of description for quantum mechanics. And it's not just generalizing things. We'll find that actually it's even more natural and quite enlightening to think about things in this framework, moving out of the idea of Hilbert space and now thinking of working in an operator space. And in fact, things start to get a bit mixed up a bit. You talk to some experimentalists, and they say, well, it's sort of a good theorist picture of what happens in an experiment. But sometimes I do a measurement on a system, and then it keeps going. You know, I want to know what happened after the measurement. The quantum system is changing as a result of that measurement, and I can have more steps. So there's a real sense in which, in understanding the full range of what could be a quantum measurement, it should look a bit more like a transformation that gives me a measurement result but changes the system. Wave function collapse or something like that, and the system keeps going. Similarly, you might say, well, how do I do a preparation in a lab? Well, some experimentalists say, oh, the way I prepare my quantum system is actually to measure it and to use the post-measurement state, because that's when I can say, oh, I've prepared this particular state. You sort of do that in a Stern-Gerlach experiment. The first thing you do to sort of set the direction of that electron spin is to put it through an analyzer, which is very much like a measurement. So there's a real sense in which our preparations can start to look a bit more like measurements, and the measurements look like transformations. In fact, everything starts to look within a common framework where it's not possible to divide it up into these three steps. There's now sort of one type of general object, and we're going to study the details of that. Okay, so that's a broad outline of what we're going to try to cover this morning and into tomorrow. Is this you've seen this? We'll do some very quick review of some things, but really trying to introduce these new concepts down here. The idea of fully general quantum operations, actually, we're going to leave until next week when we look at quantum noise, but we'll see some aspects of things that are part of that general framework today and tomorrow. Okay? Questions?
Good.
Okay, so let's start off with those preparations. So let's take that first view of just preparations as quantum states in a Hilbert space. So let's write that down. I'm going to describe my quantum system. So the quantum system is described by a normalized vector. You'll notice in my lectures I'll be completely schizophrenic about British versus American spelling, like any good Canadian or Australian is. So Z's and S's will appear all over the place. Why is it doing that? Okay. Normalized means length one. So it's a vector. Quantum states are described by a vector in a complex Hilbert space. When we're talking about finite dimensional quantum systems, the fact that it's a Hilbert space is largely irrelevant. So if D is finite, then we can stop saying Hilbert space. We can just say vector space. It's just a vector space. Things only become a bit trickier if you talk about infinite dimensional systems, and then you have to worry about closure and things like that. We will discuss a bit about that case next week. But for the purposes of today's lecture, I think it's fine to just restrict our attention to finite dimensional Hilbert spaces, just to wrap our heads around some of the concepts. OK, so here the only thing that I've done that is really specifying something about a specific quantum system as opposed to any quantum system, we have vectors, Hilbert space. It's only when I said dimension D that I'm now saying something specific about a quantum system that might be different from another one. So there's some fundamental questions there. Are all quantum systems with the same Hilbert space dimension identical? Is there any difference between a spin half particle and the two quantum states, polarization states of a photon, or two energy levels of an atom? Are they fundamentally the same? The machinery of quantum mechanics says, well, we can treat them as identical. The mathematics is all the same. You may impose some additional constraints on whether you're allowing that full range of states or not. But for the large part, we can really say to the question, is D the only defining parameter . Is there anything else that specifies a quantum system other than its Hilbert space dimension? Basically, yes. It is the only thing. So it would all be much easier. Easier? More general? It's this normalization condition that really is going to constrain not just our quantum states, but the set of operations we can do it, the set of measurements we can do on it. The normalization condition on a wave function, which is related to having probabilities add up to one, is going to be sort of the key rule that we use to sort of pick out of all possible transformations, what are the ones we use? Out of all possible measurements, what are the ones we use? So I'm just going to highlight that this normalization condition leads to, and I'll say almost, all of the defining properties of transformations and measurements. The almost here is something that we'll come back to. We're also going to impose a linearity condition on those things. But it won't necessarily be linearity in this Hilbert space. It'll be linearity in this more general space of operators that we're going to come to with time. So that's just sort of an aside note, and we'll come back to that. But once we impose that linearity condition, then really it's normalization, preserving normalization, that's going to set everything from then on. So really the idea, the starting point of quantum mechanics is so incredibly simple. You just have to pick a vector space, pick a dimension. That's really the only thing you get to pick if you're working in finite dimensional quantum systems. Pick a dimension, then everything with that dimension looks equivalent. And then everything follows from normalization. And that almost sounds too good to be true. All of this is actually very similar to a very classical idea When we look at just probability theory, how much can you get from just defining a probability distribution as something where the probabilities have to add up to one? The only really defining characteristic is how many events there are, and then I can talk about the space of probability distributions over those discrete set of events, and the fact that they have to, that probability distribution has to satisfy that the sum of the probabilities adds to one, tells me about all of the possible things I can do to a probability distribution in terms of transforming it, or in terms of doing a measurement and learning something about it and applying Bayes' rule. So there's this simplicity of quantum mechanics where it all comes down to what's the dimension of the space and then imposing normalization. It gives you everything of quantum mechanics, and that should seem to you very analogous to what we do with demanding probability theory. Okay, so we talked about a Hilbert space. And a vector in that space. Let's just introduce some standard notation, and this is just to make sure that everyone is familiar with it. How many people here have used Dirac notation? Excellent. Okay, so I'm not going to spend much time on it. If you're a bit unfamiliar with Dirac notation, it's very easy to learn. It's just a nice way of expressing vectors. And you can catch up on it quite quickly in any standard book. Okay, so let's for a moment examine a Stern-Gerlach experiment. And here we have some beam of particles. We're going to put it through a Stern-Gerlach analyzer, where it spins when we measure in the z direction using a gradient field in the z direction. Spins either have to come up or down. They're quantized. So we might say that the ones coming up, well, we've learned something about them. So we put what we've learned about them inside a ket. What you put inside a ket is just bookkeeping. It's anything you want. You can put smiley faces in your ket if you like that. You can put anything that's going to remind you of what you mean by that particular vector. Okay, so we might take the ones that come out the top and say those quantum systems are described by the ket 0. And what do we mean by the ket 0? The ket 0 is describing systems that will give outcome plus 1 with certainty when the Stern-Gerlach gradient is in the plus z direction. We could have called it plus z. We could have called it smiley face. Any of those things are perfectly adequate notation, as long as when you read it, when someone else you want to convey it to reads it, they're like, I know what you mean by that. Here, what we're trying to denote with that is that I can say the outcome of a particular potential future measurement with certainty. And so there's another possibility. We'll give outcome minus 1 with certainty. When we measure with a Stern-Gerlach analyzer, we only get those two outcomes. And so your immediate the conclusion you jump to, or the assumption you should make at that point, is if you think that's all there is to measure about that quantum system, that I've fully resolved with those two outcomes, the space of possible z components, then I say, oh, well, there's two quantized outcomes. I should pick a Hilbert space dimension of 2. Doesn't mean it has to be true. Could be that your experiment was too simple, you've missed something. There's actually more to it than that. But that would be your first guess. You start to say, now, is my system consistent with describing it with a Hilbert space dimension of 2? And then, of course, we know that we have a general state. We have the possibility not just of those two basis states, but of a general state. And our normalization condition is that the square, sum of the square moduli of these things is equal to 1. OK. So this should all look very old hat, right? This is how we describe the Stern-Gerlach experiment. Two possible outcomes for that measurement. That picks out two distinguishable and therefore orthogonal basis states for my two-dimensional Hilbert space. And now I say that the space of all possible states, it's more than that. I should be able to create things that are superpositions. And here, of course, you say, well, is it possible for me to make general superpositions? Do I need a full quantum description? Or can I model the system just classically with the idea of a coin that just takes two values? So the onus is now on the experimentalist to say, can I explore this greater range of possibilities? Just looking at two quantized outcomes is not enough in itself. Okay. How many people have seen the Bloch sphere before? Good. Not everyone. So we'll, it's very simple. We'll go through it in detail. It's just a identification of what is the space of quantum states in a two-dimensional Hilbert space with the points on the surface of a sphere. And this is going to be very important when we come to mixed states. So let's just make sure we're all on the same page. For d equals 2, that's what I mean when I say qubits, by the way. We had a general quantum state was some superposition of these two basis vectors. And there was a normalization condition that a squared plus b squared is equal to 1. We are familiar with the fact that the overall phase of psi is unobservable. That is, there's an equivalence relationship between, whoops, it's an I, chi. For some phase chi between 0 and 2 pi, the state described by the ket psi and the state described by the ket e to the I, chi psi, are indistinguishable by any possible quantum measurement. That overall phase is unobservable, and so we actually associate the space of physically different quantum states with an equivalence class of normalized vectors within that two-dimensional Hilbert space. And so there's ways in which you can talk about what is that space, but for our purposes, it's useful to think of it as we impose that normalization condition, and we think of that phase, unobservable phase, as like a gauge degree of freedom. It's unobservable. OK, so that means without loss of generality, we can choose A, the first coefficient, to be real and positive. Right? Because the overall phase is unimportant, let's just take out whatever the phase component of A is and throw it away. In which case, the normalization condition that mod A squared plus mod B squared equals 1 means that we can set A is equal to cosine of some angle, and B is equal to sine of that angle. And I've chosen that angle to be theta on 2 in there, thinking about what is the range of angles that will map out the space of all possible b's. Well, that is for this angle phi to be between 0 and 2 pi. And if I choose the angle in here to be theta on 2, that means theta will be between 0 and pi. That'll map out the full range of what A is and what B is. I can make A0 and B1, or B0 and A1, and anything in between. And we recognize that that space I should, I guess, have how do I get my eraser again? Here we go. Guess I should not have that there. We recognize that that just is the azimuthal and polar angles for a sphere, the surface of a sphere. So I can identify quantum states in one-to-one correspondence. By quantum states, I don't mean any vector in a Hilbert space. I mean any normalized vector in a Hilbert space where overall phase is unimportant. So I really am just talking about an equivalence class of normalized vectors up to overall phase. I can identify those things with the surface of a sphere. And we call that the Bloch sphere. A key thing to note here is that phi, unlike that chi that I wrote up above, is a relative, not an overall phase, between 0 and 1. The idea of talking about a relative phase is a basis-dependent quantity, unlike overall phase. So in defining my Bloch sphere, I've chosen my basis vectors to be 0 and 1 at the north and south pole. And then I can have any state in between. Anything that's not on the north or south pole is a superposition state of those two. And so there's a one-to-one correspondence between this equivalence class of quantum states and a vector in three-dimensional space given by that. And just a couple of things. It's so useful to use this Bloch sphere representation for qubits, but a couple of things to keep in mind. In Hilbert space, 0 and 1 are orthogonal, and so it's useful to think of them as being in right angles. But in the Bloch sphere, this is not a sphere within the Hilbert space of qubits. In the Bloch sphere, those orthogonal states are actually at opposite ends of the sphere. Okay, so they're not at right angles. They're 180 degrees apart. And there's, in fact, a distinction between the angle between any two quantum states in Hilbert space and the angle between two states on the Bloch sphere. Those angles are not equivalent, okay? So you can see that right away with 0 and 1. They are at 90 degrees, right angles in the Hilbert space. They're 180 degrees apart in the Bloch sphere. And so making sure you're careful with talking about angles in Hilbert space and talking about in terms of wave function overlap, talking about angles on a Bloch sphere, those are different things. And people have made a lot of mistakes, especially with working with qubits. When you say, do a rotation by some angle, usually they're referring to a Bloch sphere angle. But you have to make sure then when I apply that in my Hilbert space that I'm doing the right angle to represent that Bloch sphere rotation. Okay, so we'll see that come up again as we play with the Bloch sphere. But that's one to just keep in mind. The Bloch sphere is incredibly useful, but not necessarily in sort of one-to-one correspondence in terms of angles with the Hilbert space. Yeah?
Is this topologically an S2 or CP2?
So topologically, it's S2. It's the surface of a sphere. So
I thought it was CP2.
what is it?
The complex tools project.
Yeah, so as I mentioned before, when you talk about what is the space of states, we say, well, it's a vector space, but we impose normalization, so we consider only unit norm states, and then we say that the gauge degree of freedom of the overall phase is irrelevant. That leads us to CP2. So what is the distinction between that and the surface of the sphere, S2? Yeah, you've got me on the distinction there. Let's come back to that later. I got to think about that one. Enough with talking about quantum states. Let's move on to the more interesting aspects, which is measurement. I meant to scribble out that. So our simplest description of quantum measurement is to consider a perfect resolution of quantum states in a orthonormal basis of the Hilbert space. So just as we describe quantum systems by normalized state vectors like psi, we describe measurements by a basis of vectors. For example, the basis given by 0 and 1, but we can pick any two orthogonal states for our two-dimensional qubit vector space. And if it's a higher dimensional space, well, we need D vectors. Quantum mechanics, the Born rule is the rule that is completely different from the Schrodinger equation, which tells you if I measure a system, here is the probability I will get different outcomes corresponding to the different projectors, the different components of my basis that I'm projecting my state into. So consider measurement in the 0, 1 basis. Then the probability that I get the 0 outcome is just given by this inner product mod squared, which is just if psi is equal to a 0 plus b 1. And we notice that the sum of these probabilities has to be 1. So these are genuine probabilities. Normalization ensures that if I describe measurement by pick a basis for my Hilbert space and associate a measurement outcome with every element of that basis and a probability of that outcome given by the component of the quantum state I'm measuring in that basis mod squared, I will get a list of probabilities that sum to 1. The normalization condition on the state demands that if I want to associate measurements with a basis, that this is basically the only way to do it. So the key thing I wanted to mention here is that this is called the Born rule. When I refer to the Born rule from now on, I'm talking about using for my measurement projectors a way of figuring out what is the probability of measuring a quantum state and getting the measurement outcome associated with that projector given by the square modulus of this overlap. Okay? That's what the Born rule tells us. Has nothing to do with the Schrodinger equation. Can't be derived from the Schrodinger equation. This is an additional postulate you have to put into quantum mechanics. So let's just make sure we note that the Born rule, is just a way to assign probabilities to distinct outcomes. What do I mean by that? I had identified my Hilbert space itself by saying, well, let's think of the different quantized outcomes of a different of a given measurement. That's how I identified the 0 and 1 state in a Stern-Gerlach. That's how I identify a basis in general. That allows me to define my Hilbert space. But then I can ask a question, well, how can I convert that wave function into probabilities of some measurement when I try to learn those definite values? Then the Born rule gives you sort of the natural way to do that. It's useful to think about what is quantum superposition from the perspective of this sort of operational view of the Born rule. So there's been, you know, millions of words written about the meaning of Schrödinger's cat and how it really displays non-classical features. So everybody knows Schrödinger's cat, a completely morbid experiment of putting a cat in a closed box with a mechanism that converts the decay of some atom or some radioactive process, which is a fundamentally quantum mechanical decay, into the release of some poisonous gas that kills the cat. So you can start off with an atom in a superposition of having decayed or not, and convert that into a cat being in some superposition of being alive and being dead. And Schrödinger proposed this idea to try to show the ridiculousness of applying quantum mechanics to the macroscopic scale. But we're getting to the point where we can actually debate what is the meaning of this macroscopic superposition of a cat being in a superposition of alive or dead. And often, you know, people say, you know, oh, you know, when I look at the cat, it's either alive or dead. What does it mean to have a superposition of those two things? That's so non-classical. Well, you look at this state and you say, well, if I measure whether it's alive or dead, I'll, from the Born rule, find that it is alive half the time and it is dead half the time. That is not surprising. Morbid, but not surprising. There is nothing strange in that, in having those two possibilities coexisting until I look at it, because I don't know in advance of measuring is the cat alive or dead, whether it is or not. I might assign some probability distribution to it being alive or dead. When I do look at it, I resolve one of those possibilities. It turns out to be either alive or dead. And if I imagine an ensemble of such experiments, I would expect a distribution of alive cats and dead cats according to that probability. That's not what's weird about Schrödinger's cat. What's weird is the existence of another type of measurement I could have done on this box that's not to determine whether the cat is alive or dead, but to look at whether the, in doing measurement in a different basis, to look at is the cat in this superposition state, or is it in the orthogonal state, which is basically 1 on root 2 alive minus 1 on root 2 dead. There is some measurement in quantum mechanics that allows me to resolve those two possibilities. And when I measure a quantum cat like this, I will find that I get the plus outcome. I will get this positive superposition with certainty, and I will never get the other outcome. What does that mean? I don't know. What does that measurement even look like? That's a tricky one to even devise what that measurement would appear like. But what it's saying is if you restrict yourself to the classical measurement of looking at the cat is alive or dead, there's nothing bizarre or weird or quantum about this system. What would be bizarre or weird or quantum is if there was a different type of measurement in this coherence basis, the superposition basis, where I can get that outcome with certainty and the other outcome never occurs. And that's really the challenge, I guess, for the quantum experimentalists, is to try to think about macroscopic systems that are quantum mechanical in the sense that I can find such an alternative measurement where I can take something that looks like two classical probabilities, resolve it in a different basis, and find that I really can say something about that system with certainty. And I don't think we're there yet. I don't think we have definitive notions of what such an experiment would be. So I find Schrodinger's cat is a good illustration of really both what can be classically interpreted in a quantum system and what you need, what the, you know, the onus is on you to show if it's going to be quantum that there needs to be new types of measurements or something in addition to that, looking at things in a classical basis. Okay. Let's just look quickly at the indistinguishability of non-orthogonal quantum states. So this is one thing that follows right away from our still currently limited notion of measurements as pick a basis and look at the components of the quantum state in that basis. If we take true non-orthogonal quantum states, say psi 0 and psi 1, non-orthogonal meaning that this is not equal to 0. Can they be distinguished with certainty with a single measurement? That idea of a single measurement is something that was not really talked about in the early days of quantum mechanics. In fact, some people even question whether that notion made sense. In the early days of quantum mechanics, they, you know, understood the quantum mechanics of atoms and electrons and the Stern-Gerlach experiment. But everything they measured was an ensemble of many, many particles. And they thought, oh, we live in a macroscopic world. We'll never be able to measure a single quantum system once and get, you know, one of the quantized outcomes that quantum mechanics predicts. That's the type of thing that we can now do routinely in the lab, though it is a relatively recent phenomena. Basically, it's something that, except for a few exceptional systems, we've only been able to do in this century, not the last. So the idea that with one quantum measurement of one quantum system, can we distinguish those two non-orthogonal quantum states? Well, with the limited notion of measurement that we have right now, which is to pick a basis, and then we want to look at the probabilities of measurement in that basis according to the Born rule. To distinguish these things with certainty, we would demand for some measurement basis given by phi 0 and phi 1. You want the outcome of phi 0 to be such that if I get that outcome, I say, oh, it was the state 0 with certainty. And I want phi 1 to be, oh, it was the state 1 with certainty. That means we demand that those outcomes occur with certainty. The probability of getting 0 given the state 0 is equal to the probability of getting the outcome 1 given the state 1. Those both have to be 1. And the probability of getting the wrong outcome has to be 0. You can see that we can't do that. If those states are non-orthogonal in a two-dimensional quantum space, there is no basis that will give component 1 for one of the states and component 0 for the other. And the same is also true for the orthogonal measurement outcome. So here's a question. So what we would like from the Born rule, so we can figure out what these measurement outcomes are, probability of 0 given 0 has to equal that. If we want that to equal 1, we basically have to have phi naught is equal to psi naught. That's the only way we can be assured that if I'm given a state 1, it will give the outcome, this is the state one, or sorry, the state zero. This is the only way I can be assured that given a state psi zero, I get the outcome, yes, it is the state psi zero with certainty. And similarly, this guy has to equal that. And the only way to get that equal to 1 is that psi has to equal, psi 1 has to equal phi 1. But we want the measurement to be in a basis, so that means psi naught and psi 1, phi naught and phi 1 have to be orthogonal, but the original states were not orthogonal. So we can't satisfy that. So here's a question for you. Whoops. What's the best we can do? Why don't I give you guys a couple minutes to try to think about if I can't discriminate these two orthogonal states with certainty, well, that means I can only discriminate them with some probability. What measurement should I choose in order to try to distinguish these two quantum states such that I have, on average, say I'm giving psi 0 or psi 1 with 50-50 probability. You have to tell me which one it is. You want to maximize your expected probability of success, of getting the right answer. What measurement should I do? We can't demand both these two conditions, but we want to maximize the average probability of success. Take a moment, talk about it with your neighbor, see if you can come up with an answer.
If you measure something, then you measure an operator, right? An operator, which is your mission, which means that we can write A as being.
So here's a little hint. I find it easiest to think about this geometrically. So in my two-dimensional complex vector space, I might as well just choose the phases of those two states such that they sit in a real plane. And then here they are, not at right angles to each other because they're not orthogonal. Okay, I'm not in the block sphere picture, I'm in Hilbert space, and I've written two non-orthogonal quantum states. Think of a measurement. What should be the directions of the measurement vectors, the two orthogonal vectors that I need to project onto that'll minimize the expected probability of error? Keep talking.
The measurement is just measuring sum of it. You can write any operator in your mission either way. It is. I believe it's a bunch of A and B. And A and B doesn't matter as long as it's different. Because the only thing you want to do is distinguish between the two. It doesn't matter what you call your false space. The only thing you And then what you want to maximize is something like you want to maximize to give the description. Go to like a site and I choose size around. What if I get size prime, then I choose size around. And I think my position is like close down. So you can then write down the probability that you're and you want to maximize that you would want that. But you can actually write it back. It's just asking, you can just measure it in any direction.
Okay, well, why don't we sketch out the solution, and I'm sort of going to give you the answer and talk about it a bit, but I won't prove it, and I'll leave it to you guys to fill in the details. We need to find a measurement basis. That means two orthogonal states. So we need to put down two states at right angles that are going to discriminate these two states that are not at right angles. The answer will depend on the prior probabilities. Ooh, that's a bad right angle, isn't it? Let's see if I can fix that. Yeah. Let's try that again. That's still pretty bad. That is supposed to be at right angles. And so this dotted line that bisects these two states, I want to have that same dotted line be at 45 degrees to those two states right there. So this one, it's phi naught. This one is phi 1. These two, you mean?
Yeah.
So the point is, these two states are at any unknown angle. So we know what those states are, but they're not orthogonal. So the solution will work if that angle is small or if that angle is large. If that angle was 90 degrees, they're orthogonal states, we can distinguish them with certainty. If they're at 45 or 10 degrees or anything, we can't. Other than 90, we won't be able to distinguish them. But we pick two orthogonal states that are symmetric about the axis of symmetry of these two non-orthogonal states. Now you see that when I look at the component of the state psi naught in the phi naught direction, it will be fairly large. There's going to be a large probability that when I'm given this state, that this one will go off, and that I will say I've got the right outcome. And there's a large probability if I'm given this state that this one will go off, and I will again have guessed the right outcome. But this drawing is horrible, but this state has a small but non-zero component in this direction. So sometimes I'll be given a state psi 1, and I'll think that it is the zero state. There's some probability, there's some component of this state in this direction. So with some probability given this state, I will think it is the zero state. And there's some probability given this state, I will think it is the one state. So I will occasionally report an error. The fact that I've chosen them to, they have to be at right angles, the fact that I've chosen them to be symmetric around these two states has to do with that prior probability of getting this state with 50% of the time and this state with 50% of the time. If I was always given this state, I would tilt such that this one goes onto that direction. and I'd always get the right answer. If I was told I was always going to get this state, I would tilt it the other way, since that this measurement vector is along that direction, and I always get the right answer. But if I'm told I don't know which state I'm getting, 50-50 chance of each, then I should balance my probabilities of getting one or the other wrong. And that's what leads me to that symmetric solution. So that's what it would be on the onus of you if you want to fill in the details and prove it, is that you can prove it for any given prior distribution of these two, what's the right measurement direction. Show that if I'm given a 50-50 chance of state psi 0 or psi 1, then I should choose the orthogonal states to sort of be balanced around those two non-orthogonal states. Yeah?
Why, for example, wouldn't we want to pick one of the, like, phi 0 to be, psi 0 to be phi 0, and then construct an orthogonal one, and, okay, well.
So that's great. Let's think about what would happen if we did that. Let me pick this orthogonal direction to be like that. So that means if I am given a state psi 0, I will always get the right answer. I always say, yep, that was definitely the 0 state. If I'm given the 1 state, then sometimes I'll get the right answer and sometimes I'll get the wrong answer. So you can check out what is the problem. So that is a good candidate for a discriminating measurement. One of the possibilities is always right, and the other fails with some probability. If I was given these states with 50-50 probability, then whatever the probability of failure for this one is, the probability of failure in my total scheme will be half that. And you can show that choosing this balance condition actually lowers the average failure probability relative to that case you just gave. But if I was given a different prior distribution, if I was told, I'm going to give you states to discriminate, it's very, very likely I'm going to give you the state 0, but I might throw in a trick for you and give you the state 1, then I would probably use your measurement if I wanted to just get the best probability of the right answer. So it depends a lot on what is that prior. You're trying to learn something about that distribution, and so I choose my measurement accordingly.
Does this result hold when you take into account that, like, there could be relative phases and stuff? Because you're kind of, this is a real vector space, right? A real 2D vector space. But you should be able to, like, rotate some states out of the page.
Yeah, so what I've done is you can basically pick for any two vectors. Let me just pick the plane of which those two vectors are in, and work. You can show that you can work entirely in that plane. Going outside of that plane doesn't help at all with phases.
Like your phis, you can pick to define the real plane, right? And but then, why can't you say that one of the psis will have a phase relative?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, it's not completely obvious. You should try to show that choosing the phase of the phi, you know, given the plane defined by the two psi states, the input states, choosing the phi measurement vectors outside of that plane doesn't help at all. And it's partly because the Born rule probabilities depend only on the square modulus of the overlap. So you can show that adding phases in there will not make any difference. So what's nice about this, the solution to this problem is it works in any dimensional Hilbert space. If I'm still talking about two vectors, it doesn't matter how big my Hilbert space is. Those two vectors always will span a two-dimensional real plane in that Hilbert space, and I can use the same solution. So it's quite a general solution in that sense. It's probably a good time to stop and take our break. Does that sound good, Aggie? Yeah. So we start again at?
It's on your.
Oh, yeah. At 10:45. OK, so let's come back at 10:45 and go for another 75 minutes.